Welcome to Global Leader Radio, sponsored by the Executive MBA program at Kennesaw State University, discussing ideas that matter with people who care. Now here's your host, Director of Business Development and Instructor of Management for the Executive MBA program at Kennesaw State University, Alvin Miles.
Happy Tuesday and welcome to another episode of Global Leader Radio. The purpose of our show is to engage in conversations that highlight our guests, educate our learning community, and benefit all those who seek to optimize their leadership acumen. So we achieve this purpose by providing our learning community with key takeaways, including resources and advice that have led to the personal and professional success of our guests. And we've got two great ones today. So with that overview, welcome Becky Blaylock and Lisa Earl McLeod. Becky Blaylock is a partner with Advisory Capital, where she provides strategic consulting and is a board member of companies involved in energy, IT, and medicine. She formerly served as a senior vice president and CIO, or chief information officer, of the Southern Company for 9 years. In this role, she directed IT strategy and operations across the 9 subsidiaries of Southern Company. So Becky has received a host of honors, including the 2011 Legacy Award from Women in Technology and Honorary Lifetime Achievement Award from the Georgia CIO Leadership Association. In 2009, she was named CIO of the Year in the electric utility industry by Energy Biz magazine. She is a tireless advocate for women and children and has been recognized as Power Woman by Atlanta Woman magazine, and received the Shining Star Award from the Atlanta Women's Foundation. She's written a book titled Dare, and it will be released in the fall of 2013. So Lisa Earl McLeod is the principal of a sales leadership consultancy named McLeod and Moore Incorporated, and she works in the arena of sales leadership, and organizations like Apple, Kimberly-Clark, and Pfizer hire her to help them create passionate, purpose-driven sales organizations. So she is the best-selling author of Selling with Noble Purpose. Lisa has contributed to the Huffington Post, and she's appeared on the Today Show and the NBC Nightly News. Her 2011 book, The Triangle of Truth, The Surprisingly Simple Secret to Resolving Conflicts Large and Small, was named by the Washington Post as a top 5 book for leaders, which certainly qualifies you both as perfect candidates for Global Leader Radio. So Lisa's been featured in Fortune, Forbes, The Wall Street Journal, and the New York Times. So given that overview, we welcome both Becky and Lisa to today's edition of Global Leader Radio. So ladies, how are you today?
Great. I'm feeling quite impressed with both of us after listening to that introduction. Wow, yeah. Who wrote that? I can't wait to hear what we have to say.
That makes 3 of us.
Wow.
And Kevin here as well.
Kevin is just wow.
So, Becky, let's begin with you, if you're okay with that, Lisa. So please tell us a little bit about your background, starting with your birthplace, your home, a little bit about your work experience, and take us up to the present.
Yeah, Alvin, I had a very interesting childhood in that I went to 4 high schools, 3 junior highs, 8 elementary schools. I was an Air Force brat. And at the time, I really hated that when I was growing up. But I look back on it now and I think, you know, that really was a gift because I was constantly thrown into new situations. Mm. And so I think I grew up always embracing change. And in college, like most college students, went off, wasn't exactly sure what I wanted to do. Had an internship with a marketing professor who said, you know, you're really good in math and you're really good at looking at lots of data and seeing trends. So I ended up in marketing.
Hmm.
And was recruited right out of college to go to work for Georgia Power Company. Although my degree was in marketing, I worked in accounting, went in their accounting training program, and had the opportunity to do lots of things over a 33-year career with what I think is one of the finest companies in corporate America. Did everything from run a district office to running corporate communications to running business development, and then spent the last 9 years as the chief information officer. Oftentimes I had people say to me, you know, gee, you didn't grow up in IT. How did you end up running such a highly technical department? And the higher up the corporate ladder you go, the more the job is about not being the subject matter expert, although you have to be able to learn and grasp certainly the very strategic issues quickly, but who you surround yourself with.
Mm, good point.
And I think I was very fortunate when I was in that position to have some incredibly talented people who helped me be very successful in that role. And then 18 months ago, I retired from the company, and I haven't been very retired. I actually tell people this is phase two, because there is a whole exciting world that comes next. And wrote this book, which will be released in the fall, and am consulting with a company called Mahindra Sachem, which is actually based out of India, and helping them grow their North American operations. And I've gone on the board of a number of companies, both nonprofit and profit.
Well, that's impressive. So tell us a little bit about your time at the Southern Company, particularly the 9 years where you spent as CIO. How many female CIOs were there at the time you were at the Southern Company?
Well, not many, although I will say that I had five regional CIOs who reported to me, and three of those women. Three of the CIOs were women reporting directly to me. And then in the utility industry, a lot of the vendors who supported the industry said it was very unusual in that about half of my peers, half of the CIOs at major corporations were women, and that's something you don't see in any other industry. But in Atlanta, I will never forget, right after I was first named a chief information officer, I went to a big meeting, and a large vendor was having a reception, and I walked in the door. There were probably 200 people there, and I was the only woman in the room other than the woman handing out the name badges.
Wow.
And I thought, wow, you know, I'm used to sort of being a minority, being working inside a utility, because there are not very many women inside the utility industry. But I really thought that IT would have been a lot different, because my own team at Southern Company was at least 30% female. So to walk into that room was very telling to me that the industry had a long way to go. And it has improved some.
Okay.
It's better, but you just don't see a lot of young girls growing up aspiring to be the CIO. So I think we've really got to do a lot to try to change that change the industry, change the mindset, and help people understand that IT is really a very exciting place to be. It's all about, you know, technology and what's coming in the future and how it's going to revolutionize our lives. And I just can't think of any place better to be, but somehow it's getting a bum rap.
Yeah, well, interesting. With regard to the work you do as partner with Advisory Capital, tell us a little bit about what you're doing there.
Well, my big client is Mahindra Sachem, and as I mentioned, they are a large company. They don't have a lot of name recognition in the U.S. Because they were just acquired in 2009 by Mahindra. But they have 140,000 employees worldwide and about 10,000 in the U.S. And they do all kinds of consulting on the technology side, everything from telecom to application development work to infrastructure work as well. And so I have learned an awful lot just culturally working with an international company, because you'll do a conference call and you've got people all over the world on the phone. And typically if there's somebody in India and they're in the car, you're hearing the horn honk. So you've got to say, put the phone on mute. So there's just a lot of nuances that if you have just worked for an American company, you really don't get exposed to unless you're working more internationally. And in addition to consulting with them, I'm also doing a lot of board work with other companies.
Okay.
And of course, I've been writing the book as well.
Okay. All right. Well, good. What do your ideal clients, I mean, above and beyond Mahindra, what do they typically have in common? Or is there an ideal client for you in your consultancy work?
Well, you know, I get almost a call a week from somebody wanting me to do a little something for them. I'm actually talking to a company tomorrow who needs some help on the lobbying side. At one point in time in my life, I was a lobbyist.
Okay.
And so they needed some help with somebody that had relationships and knew how to help them address an issue that they've got going on. So there's really no standard cookie cutter, but most of what my expertise is in the IT side and how to do business development within that umbrella.
Excellent. So let's fast forward to the book. So what was the reason why you decided to write there?
You know, I've always done a lot of speaking, mostly to women's groups. And I think that once you learn something, you forget that other people don't know it. And that when I speak, I would always be amazed. There would be a lot of people lined up wanting to ask questions and wanting more information and have a lot of stories to share from 33 years in corporate America. And And so I thought, you know, and a lot of people encouraged me. They said, you really need to take these stories and put them down on paper so that the next generation of women leaders coming behind you can learn from some of the mistakes that you make coming up the, up the corporate ladder. And you know, they say that you really should explore something that you're really passionate about in life, because if you find what you're really passionate about, then it can really excite you and just make you happier than you could ever imagine. And I have always loved coaching and bringing other people along. Mm-hmm. When I look back on my career and I think about what am I most proud of, I'm most proud of people who have worked under my leadership and have then grown and gone on to do other great things in their life, and especially as it relates to women. So I thought, you know, if I'm going to write a book, I really want to do something that helps that next generation of women come along, helps them learn from some of the things that the mistakes that I made. And also, you know, I do have some things that I did right, and I should write about them. And there are a good many other successful women out there. So one of the things about my book is it's not just my story. There are 29 other really accomplished, very successful women, one of whom is Dr. Betty Siegel, who is a former president of Kennesaw College, who are profiled in the book as well.
Hmm.
But it comes out in October, and I hope that it will be helpful. The other thing is that, you know, women are so reluctant to take risk.
Mm-hmm.
We just have not grown up really being encouraged. You know, guys tend to grow up daring each other to do things, daring each other to take risks. And if they fall and break their leg, then they pick them up or take them to the doctor and they get well. And as women, we have not been as good about daring each other to take risk and then being there to support each other if it doesn't work out. And so that's where the title of the book came from, to try to encourage women to take more risks, because everybody has confidence and courage issues and challenges, men and women, but they're much greater with women than they are with men. And so my book is to try to encourage women not to be afraid to take those risks and to be more courageous and believe in themselves and to be there to support and help that next generation that's coming along too.
Well, thank you for that. I do know that the foreword was written by Ann Mulcahy, the former chairman and CEO of the Xerox Corporation, so I take it you and Ann are friends.
Ann has been a great mentor to me over the years. I was a big Xerox customer at Southern Company, and so our paths crossed. And she's just, to me, a great role model for all women. She rescued Xerox when she took over as CEO. The company was literally about to go down the tubes.
Wow.
And she, you know, totally reorganized, refocused all of their efforts, raised all the money from investors that it took to get the company back on the right path, and they were doing extremely well by the time she left. So she's been highly successful in business, but she's also very passionate about giving back and helping women. And a number of times I called on her when I was in the job as the CIO to come in and talk to women in our company, mm-hmm. to come in. She was a great keynote speaker for the Georgia CIO Leadership Association one year when we had our big event. She's just a very giving, kind person. And when I asked her to write the foreword to the book, she didn't hesitate.
She was the perfect candidate.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you for your time. I just want to pivot just slightly and move over to chat with Lisa McLeod, and she's the best-selling author of Selling with Noble Purpose and the principal of a sales consultancy practice called McLeod and More Incorporated. So tell me, what's the more? I'm from Louisiana, you know, we believe in Lanyap.
You know, it's funny because I started the consulting practice about 18 years ago, and I just started out as a solo, and I put the more on there kind of as a joke because I thought one day we're going to be more than just me.
It was aspirational then.
It was aspirational at that moment, and now it actually is more. I didn't realize where it was going to go at the time, but we have a consulting practice that focuses on organizations and how they can better emotionally engage their salespeople, their mm-hmm. leaders, and their customers. And so I have a number of other consultants that work with me in a variety of capacities.
Oh,
and
fantastic.
My husband's also part of the more.
Oh. Very good. So to begin with, please tell us a little bit about the woman behind Lisa McLeod, starting with your original birthplace, and take us up to the present.
Well, you know, it's funny. When Becky was talking and I was thinking about how much where you're born and how you're raised affects your worldview.
That's right.
You know, you mentioned I wrote a book called The Triangle Kernel of Truth, which is a book on conflict resolution. And I was born and raised in Washington, D.C. So, and the whole premise of that book is about just because I'm right doesn't mean you're wrong, and how you can bring two sides together. And I see now, upon reflection, that going to school, I mean, two of the people I went to high school with were congressman's son. At the time, they were mostly congressmen, not too many congresswomen. I went to school with a Republican and a Democrat, and they were beside each other on the soccer field cheering their sons on. And it was a very different environment then than it is now. When I grew up in Washington, D.C., and I later moved to Georgia, and I went to school at University of Georgia in Athens. But when I was growing up in Washington, D.C., it's a big difference from now, because congressmen and senators actually lived in D.C., and they came home on the weekend. And so it was decided, I think with really good intention several years ago, that congressmen and senators should live in their district and just be in D.C. like Monday through Thursday. But what happened was all of those social interactions went away.
That's right.
And so I think back to my growing up, and it wasn't just the congressmen's the Republican, the Democrat on the sidelines. It was all these people whose parents worked for various, you know, politicals in different parties. And they went to PTA together, and they had barbecues together. And then they may have still had ideological differences. But it's really hard to demonize someone when last Saturday you were both cheering on your kids. And so that's a really important change that has taken place that I don't think people realize what a chilling effect it had on our politics. Having said that, I'm not a political consultant. I am a leadership and sales consultant. But what I saw in that moment, I realized some of the lessons I learned growing up were how the ability to hold a space for the other person's perspective emotionally and literally in an agenda in a meeting actually produce a better outcome. So I went to school at University of Georgia, and then my background is pretty hardline sales. I worked for Procter & Gamble, and I was in sales management. I was out in the field as a sales trainer with them. I left there after getting to a sales leadership position, and I went to work for a consulting firm that specialized in sales, and then I left there and started my own firm. And so some of the things that I've done since were really based on some of the gaps that I saw, like this conflict resolution book. And I realized most of my work is, you know, the triangle of truth. So I also wrote Being Born and Raised in Washington, D.C., Forget Perfect. But but the new thing that I've done, Selling with Noble Purpose, was rooted in some of the same thinking, in that it was not just seeing the behaviors, but really trying to unpack the mindset of people and what determined the difference between success and happiness and failure and unhappiness.
Yeah, which was a key as I read some of the work that you did, and also on your website. There's, and Becky and I were talking a little bit about that in the green room earlier. There are two perspectives. Either you can focus on profit, or you can focus on selling with noble purpose, which gets you to the profit.
Yeah, and the data is absolutely clear. You know, and working in sales, the thing that I got called in to do so often was, you know, a sales leader or CEO would say, okay, we have this team or this group of people that are the top performers, and then we have this giant bell curve with all these people in the middle. What can we do to get the people in the middle to produce at the level that the top performers do? And so this is a constant in any type of leadership capacity, but particularly in sales, where it's so measurable and has such a direct impact on the bottom line. And what people typically focus on are the behaviors. Are these people better at working with senior executives? Are these people, do they have a better plan? Do they have a better message? And what I realized was it wasn't the behaviors, it was the internal talk track. And the internal talk track drives behaviors. And so I thought, I'm going to figure this out. And the data is absolutely clear, and it proves what we already know in our hearts to be true, which is people who sell, and I use the word sell to mean whether you're selling a product, you're in a traditional sales role, or whether you're selling your ideas, or whether you're selling your team as a leader. People who sell with a sense of noble purpose, who really want to make a difference in other people's lives, drive more revenue than people who are focused on sales targets and money. And it works at an individual level, and it also plays out at a collective level. A colleague of mine, Jim Stengel, that I used to work with at Procter & Gamble, has done a 10-year study of global brands. And in that 10-year study, the brands whose sole purpose was to make a difference in their customers' lives, who wanted to improve people's lives, who brought that to the front and center of everything they did, outperformed the S&P. There's 50 brands that he identified did that over a 10-year period, and they outperformed the S&P by almost 400%.
And the name of that book again was?
His book is called Grow.
Got it, correct.
He's a marketing expert. Yes. I'm a sales expert.
Yes, yes.
But the data is absolutely clear, whether you're talking about it from a messaging standpoint, most importantly, from a leadership standpoint. And it's literally the difference between a CEO who stands up there at the annual meeting and says, this year we're going to make $1 million, versus a CEO who, or $1 billion or whatever it may be, versus the CEO who stands up there and says, this year we're going to change 1 million lives.
Wow.
At the end of the year, the one who says we're going to change 1 million lives is going to drive more revenue, his company's going to be more profitable, and he's going to have a more emotionally engaged team.
And that assumes that everything is being cascaded throughout the organization and people understand it and buy
if he
in.
He just says it.
You got to read your book, right?
Yeah. And then he goes off.
It doesn't quite work the same.
Cackling, saying, I pulled the wool over their eyes, Mr. Scrooge, don't you think? Then it's probably not going to work.
Probably not going to work. So overall, Lisa, what was the driver for beginning your practice? So you saw a gap in the market, and or did your research lead you into the area where you're working today?
My research led me into the area where I'm working today, and some of the work I did in the field with sales teams led me to the area I'm working today.
Okay.
But I will be quite honest with you, why I went off and started my own consulting business was because I was the VP of Business Development for a consulting firm. I was all over the country. I was working a 70 or 80 hour week.
Wow.
And I had a baby.
Mm.
And so I thought, I mean, I wish I could tell you that it was this grand plan and it was this desire to be all I could be. But it was actually probably started with the desire to be a little less. But I remember thinking and talking to my husband, and I know, you know, this is an ongoing debate. And, you know, you talk about, I was really struck by Becky's comment about women don't take risk. And upon reflection, I think that that was a big risk, and I'm glad I didn't really realize what a big risk it was.
You might have talked yourself out of it.
I probably wouldn't have done it. But I just thought, you know, I can't live this life the way I want to live it. And my whole focus is about leadership and people's internal talk track and their mm-hmm. development and how your beliefs inform your culture and how they affect all the people around you. So what am I going to do? I've just given birth to the President of the United States, or the
That's
future
right.
President of the United States. I'm not going to go leave her at home.
That's right.
Leave that to somebody else, you know?
That's a big responsibility.
That's right, man. The world's counting on this thing.
So ladies, let's talk a little bit about this internal talk track. Tell me what you mean by saying that. I mean, is it literally the thoughts that run through our minds and that we can control these thoughts, or...
Yeah, you can, and it's the way that you're showing up. And there's a lot of data. Some of it was from the Professor Maribian at the UCLA School of Psychology years ago, and it shows that people are reading you, and what they're reading is they're reading your body language, your facial expressions, and your tone, and those are informed by your internal talk track. So if I show up and I say to you, Alvin, I'm delighted to be on your show today. Or if I say, hey, Alvin, thanks for having me on the show. I'm so excited. Do you know, I mean, I can say the exact same words, but you can hear what I'm feeling. And what we often don't recognize is, especially in a corporate environment, is how much of your internal talk track, a lot of it comes from you, but a lot of it is dictated to you without you even realizing it by your leadership. What the leadership says and does becomes the narrative of the organization. So if the leaders, like at Southwest Airlines, if the leaders say, we are here to democratize the skies because we want people to fly that could never fly before, that then becomes your purpose and your internal talk track. I mean, I'm sure you saw that play out in your work.
Oh, absolutely, Lisa. It's so interesting because I write about some of this in my book because, you know, really as human beings, we are not programmed to be positive. We are really programmed to be negative, and we remember negative events a lot more than we remember positive events. And that comes from thousands of years of evolution. When you think about as man was coming along, it was the cautious person that survived and the person who remembered those negative events. And the negative events are not all bad. I mean, you know, you don't want to stick your hand in a candle. I mean, you want to, you know, you want to remember
that
because it hurts you.
Yeah.
But it's the species that survived that was negative and that was cautious. And so what you have to do is really reprogram yourself to be more accepting of risk and to not talk yourself out of doing things. We speak at about 150 to 250 words a minute, but at the same time, you are thinking at 1,300 words a minute.
Yeah.
And even though you're saying something, you may be talking, we're constantly talking ourselves out of things. And what you have to do is get a grip on that And people will try to convince you, too, that you can't do things. But you've really, if you can define that purpose that you talk about, because I tell people, if you really want to be a strong leader, it's got to begin within. And you have to really understand what it is that you want. And that's easy to say, but it's hard to really understand what it is and get your arms around it. And then once you do, that begins to drive everything. I am really convinced that there isn't anything you can't do if you want to and if you believe in it enough. And that's why getting to that purpose and finding out what it is you really want, you can become unstoppable. Mm. And the other thing is just being aware. I wish somebody had told me that everybody had these confidence issues. I thought it was just me all those years. But we all suffer from that. But women in particular want to be liked. Men do too, but it's not as important to them as it is to us. If you look at the research, women are much more obsessed with that. Although I want to put a caveat on that. You know, people that say women are from Venus and men are from Mars. Well, there are a lot of men that are on Venus, and there are a lot of women that are on Mars. I think you have to be careful when you say all men are like this and all women are like this.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You know, and look at people individually. But there are some, you know, situations that tend to be more prone to women, and being liked is one of them. And we let that stop us sometimes from jumping out front and doing things if we know it's going to make other people unhappy. And if you really want to be a senior leader, you've got to get focused on what's the right thing, get your heart around what that purpose is, and then that will drive you and help you achieve what it is that you want to do.
Great thought.
Well, the likability thing for women is so huge. I mean, I've struggled with that all my life, and I was in sales, so you think you want people to like you. But as you move up, even in a sales capacity, and I had someone tell me the other day, this was about 6 months ago, a mentor of mine said, and I was struggling with a certain client situation, and I was dealing with the CEO, and a bunch of the people at the lower level were unhappy with it. And he said, there's no way you can enact these changes and have these people like you. And it was like, oh, right, right, right there. Just get over it. And it's, you know, you've seen some of the research that was cited in the book Lean In, where she talked about this. Women don't just make this up in our head. The power is positively correlated to likability in men and negative correlated to likability in women, negatively correlated. And so what that means is, you know, very rarely will a man come into power and make tough decisions and be called anything other than tough leader. Mm-hmm. But a woman gets into power and she makes those tough decisions, and we know what the word is for her.
Mm. Starts with a B.
Yeah. and the challenge is, you know, you look at some of these men, you know, you talk about from an evolutionary standpoint, you're right. You know, men are traditionally, and this is not a bad thing or a good thing, it's just what it is. Mm. Evolutionarily, men actually got rewarded for taking risk. Because if you think about it from an evolutionary standpoint, if a guy takes a risk and says, I'm going after that beast, and all these other guys are chicken, but I'm going to go after it, and I'm going to see if I can't bag that big whatever it is, saber-toothed tiger for my, you know, village or my woman. Okay, so maybe he'll die, high likelihood. But if he doesn't, he's going to be rewarded, and he's going to get the best woman, and he's going to probably get an exalted position in the village. But women, whether we have children or not, are biologically programmed to protect and nurture. And so that often prevents us from taking risks. Now, we all know those same type of behaviors that can serve you so well in, you know, a million years ago or a couple thousand years ago, in today's time, that same guy is likely going to take such a risk, he's going to make a really stupid decision with his company's finances. Or we might hold back. And so it's just knowing. To your point, I wish someone had told me that earlier. I wish someone had told me, you know, and where was your book? Where were you 20 years ago? You know, I wish someone had told me, you're going to be less predisposed to take risks than a guy, and you need to be aware of this. Because in my case, that was true. Or I wish someone had told me, you're going to have to make tough decisions, and you're going to have to be at peace that not everybody's going to like you.
Hmm. Yeah. And, you know, that's why I think mentors are so important.
Right.
Because you can have somebody who's not as invested in a particular situation as you are, who can, you know, look at what's happening from an outsider standpoint and coach you and be somebody that you can go to and say, yeah, maybe they don't like you. My dad used to always have this term called dogs don't chase parked cars. And he used to say, you know, if you're out front and you're driving change and creating work for other people or changing the way they do things, then they're not going to be happy. And he said, so you've just always got to focus on the fact that, you know, there'll be some dogs chasing after you. You've either got to try to convince them to run with you or outrun them. And not let that be the thing that holds you back. Certainly, you need to listen to the barking dogs, make sure you've got all your facts. But if you, you know, have your facts and you know that what you're doing is right, you just need to continue to stay very focused on that.
And at the same time, you still have to elicit support from leadership to make sure that your agenda can still be carried out, right?
Absolutely. And that's where sponsors come in. You know, there are, fortunately, are a lot of mentors out there now. As I was coming up in my career, there were no other women at a senior level in my company to mentor me. So men mostly were my mentors. And there was I had a lot of peer mentors. There were a group of us who were coming up together at the same time. So a lot of female peer mentors. And I tell people mentors are all around you. They may, in fact, be somebody that reports to you. And there were people that reported to me that I thought, gosh, I like the way they're doing that. I'm going to emulate that next time. But a sponsor is very different from a mentor. A sponsor is somebody who's in a high-level position in the company that can advocate on your behalf, which is very important because at the most senior levels in a company, one person doesn't typically make the hiring decision. It's made by a committee. And you've really got to have somebody who's a strong advocate for you sitting around the table, because you can bet that when your name comes up for discussion, there'll be somebody else there who has someone else they want in the job. So having those sponsors is important. In terms of being able to advocate for you. They're harder to find, but sometimes if you pick your mentors well, your mentors will one day be in a position to be able to sponsor you in a particular position. Sponsors also important because if you do take a risk and you go into a job and it doesn't work out, then they can help bail you out.
Yes.
So a sponsor can give you a lot of courage and confidence to go in and do something.
And take risks.
And take risk, particularly if you know you've got somebody who's going to help you help bail you out if it doesn't work out.
And that's important. And also take the dare every now and again, too, right?
Absolutely.
So with regard to your book, Becky, what's the biggest takeaway?
I think there's a couple. First of all, understand what it is that you want. Know what it is that you want. Because if you know what it is, you can become unstoppable. So get very clear. Begin within and figure that out. And then the second thing is, don't be afraid to take risk, because if you really want to be successful in the corporate arena, going back to school and getting an educational background is great, but what really grows your skills and grows your ability to be able to move into those senior levels is experience. And accept the fact that you're going to fail at some things. And don't be afraid to fail. Don't beat yourself up if you do. Learn from it. Because it's so important that you have those experiences. That's what really grooms you and grows you for those next levels. And then I guess the third message is, don't be afraid to give back. Building a strong network is certainly important. Nobody gets to be at the senior level in a company by doing things on their own. You've got to surround yourself with a very diverse and very talented group of people if you want to be successful. And so spend a lot of time giving back and helping those people that help you.
Yeah, you know, interestingly enough, we were talking in the green room before, and when we were talking about the second phase of your life, being retired as from the CIO ship of the Southern Company, and now you're pretty busy. And so with regard to that, you were telling me that the majority of the engagements and board type of offers you've gotten to serve on boards has come from your work in the nonprofit sector, not from anything you did for profit.
Well, it's really a combination of both. But when I was the CIO, I was very involved in a lot of nonprofits. I've always believed that, you know, if you have to give to get, and that I was in a position where I could do a lot to help an awful lot of people, and so I invested a lot in nonprofits. And so many of the relationships that I built helped me back with my job at work. And a lot of those relationships that I built are the ones that really helped me after I retired, not only with my consulting practice, but also a lot of companies that have come to me with board positions, private equity board positions. All of those are through relationships I made in the nonprofit community.
So is there a takeaway in there someplace where if a person's struggling today to find employment that they should perhaps just start investing in one of the nonprofits that fit their particular needs and something that they can give back to, and then perhaps things will turn around? Maybe it's a karma
thing.
Well,
not only if you're not employed, but I used to always counsel and coach people because, you know, a big breakthrough in leadership comes in getting that first leadership position. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of chicken and the egg. You know, a lot of people are very good at a particular profession, but then moving into management is a challenge.
Okay.
If you don't have that experience, companies tend to be reluctant to want to, you
give
know, be the first ones
first
to
one,
give it
yeah.
to you. So you can get that experience by being in a leadership role in a nonprofit. I mean, you have to have a budget. You've got to recruit volunteers, you typically have staff, you've got goals and objectives. Those are the same kinds of skills and things that you need if you're going to run an organization inside a company. And you can get those a lot quicker by volunteering with a nonprofit. And at the same time, you can grow your internal passion by having an opportunity to support something that you really believe in and make a difference in our community.
Well, thank you for that. What a great message. And the same thing goes with you, Lisa. I'd love to understand a couple of the takeaways from your book, Selling with Noble Purpose. Certainly, you know, we're actually going to get you to define what that noble purpose should look like or what it should be for us. But from a global perspective, a macro perspective.
So here's the main point. Organizations that have a noble sales purpose outperform organizations that are just focused on financial metrics. Peter Drucker once says, profit is not the purpose of a business, it is the test of its validity. And so one of the things I say in the book is driving revenue is not the purpose of a sales force, it is the test of their effectiveness. And here's what I mean by this. A noble sales purpose is a declarative statement about how you make a difference to your customers. For example, one of my clients provides IT services to small businesses, and that's how they used to describe themselves. They said, oh, we do IT services for small businesses. And if you listen to that, that's a fine statement. And their mission was, we want to be the number one provider of IT services. Well, who's that focused on? That's focused
on them.
And that's fine to want to be the number one. I certainly want to hit number one on the New York Times bestseller list. But the question is, why do you want to do it? And so we reframed their organization. And what they started saying was their noble sales purpose was, we help make small businesses more successful. And so what that does is it changes the lens by which you view every decision, every activity. So it's not just a marketing tagline, we help make small businesses more successful. But when we are making decisions about what new products do we develop? Well, which ones would help make small businesses more successful? Mm. How do we deploy our sales force? Well, how could we make our customers more successful? You know, and Steve Jobs talked about this when he talked about during the time that he was away from Apple that the focus became on profitability. And big surprise, there was very little innovation. Hmm. And he says his purpose was to really build an enduring company that made a difference to the customers. And I was just out at Apple last week, and it's still alive, and it's still there. It's challenging after a charismatic founder like that leaves. But what happens is when you put your lens on a larger purpose and you have what I refer to as a noble sales purpose, it changes the frame through which you view your business. So it's not a tactic. It's a very strategic difference.
Yes.
Changes the way you capture data about your customers. Changes the way you coach your salespeople. So I'll give you one takeaway tip that's in the book. And there's about 12 of these that are really specific action items that leaders can use. But here's one. Most of the time when you're working with a sales team, whether it's an individual salesperson or whether it's a huge team going after a big piece of business, the questions that leaders tend to ask are, when are we going to close it? Who's the competition? Do we have all the decision makers involved? What's the revenue stream? What's the profitability? But I'll share with you one question that will completely change the outcome for the better. And that's, how will this customer be different as a result of doing business with us? Every single person going after that piece of business better be able to answer that question and be able to answer it really well, because that's where you'll find your competitive differentiator. Otherwise, you'll just end up being a commodity. So that's, in a nutshell, the premise of the book. And one of the things that I did this time was, in the past, I've done books and I wrote about them and then I started implementing sort of afterwards. This mm-hmm. time, I spent a year implementing this with customers in advance of writing the book.
Interesting.
So it's got really clear case studies about What do you do for your sales meetings? What do you do in your leadership meetings? And examples from my customers, everybody from the one I just cited in small business to some examples from Apple to a bank in Bermuda to now a Canadian adventure travel company. Because I want to be really clear, top performers don't just want to make money. They also want to make a difference. And that's what this book is about your ability to do both of those things at the same time.
So thank you for that. You've actually nailed what I was going to ask earlier with regard to what do the top salespeople focus on? What are they really interested in? So at the same time, what role do the leaders play in this equation?
Well, see, the leaders are absolutely critical. So I'll give you an example of an industry that's getting everything right except the sales leadership. Look at today's automotive industry in America. So innovative, amazing. They do great customer research. They have great insights. Their marketing is fabulous. I watch these ads and I think, my God, I feel 10 years younger just looking at that car. My kids are going to be safer. This is so awesome. So they've made huge strides, huge innovations. So manufacturing is focused on improving life for the customer. R&D is focused on improving life for the customer. The marketing is messaged on improving life for the customer. And I also believe that the senior leadership of those organizations really wants to have an impact, not just on our economy, but on improving the way we go to and from places.
Right, right.
But what happens when you go to buy a car? All of that customer focus falls apart on the showroom floor. Why does it fall apart? Because that sales manager has told the salespeople, our purpose is to close the deal. So when you ask the role that leadership plays, that is a very, very telling example. But unfortunately, in a lot of companies, the same thing happens at a senior leadership level. One of the most common responses I've gotten from the book has been people that have said, I love this. I'm a top-performing salesperson. I'm a top-performing sales manager. I know this is true, but. And what do you think the but is?
Need to make the money.
No. They're already making the money.
Top already doing it. Yeah.
The but is my senior management will not go for it.
Interesting.
Because all they care about is the balance sheet. Mm. And where I would put that back is I would put that back to the board. Because if you look, and that's a common issue that I get from CEOs, which is the data's there. I want my organization to have a noble purpose. I want to leave a legacy. But my board only cares about the quarterly earnings. And, you know, one of the things I talk about in the book is how the board agenda, even though most employees are not aware of it, the agenda at that board meeting is what drives so much of what happens in the company. And so you're at that board meeting, and you may be talking a little bit about brand and messaging, but most of what you're talking about are quarterly earnings. So the whole narrative of the business becomes about dollars and cents. Now, don't get me wrong. I run a business. That's really important. My company's purpose is to help leaders drive revenue and do work that makes them proud. So I'm really clear on the numbers. But what happens is all the emotional narrative about how they make a difference to customers and how they might have a lasting impact on their industry, on their customers, and on the world, that gets stripped away at a board meeting, and then it never gets inserted back in.
Interesting. Thoughts?
I tend to agree with that. I think, you know, you've got all these high expectations on Wall Street. I look at what the market's doing now. It's continuing to just escalate on. And most of the time at the senior level, that's what they're focused on, is much more so on what they can deliver to Wall Street to drive value, when really and truly the most successful companies are also focused on, you know, customer satisfaction with their customers and employee satisfaction. Because if your employees aren't happy, your customers aren't going to be happy. And so, you know, I think the very best, the most successful companies out there are the ones who do focus on their employees and don't leave them on the wayside.
Well, I've never seen a company that had customers who were passionate evangelists that did not also have employees. Who were passionate evangelists.
And,
absolutely.
And they're not mutually exclusive. They're typically the employees are also the customers.
Yeah, you watch these companies beat the people up. About, we're going to have better customer service as I browbeat you, you know, about the head. It doesn't work.
It's the three legs of the stool. And you know, unfortunately, you know, there's so much focus on Wall Street that it gets a lot of the attention. But that's a very short-term focus. The best, most quality companies are the ones that focus on all three of those pillars simultaneously.
Well, and that's when I first started doing this work. A lot of the people that sought me out were privately held companies for that reason. And I realized that I was doing a great disservice unless I got the hard data to demonstrate. And the hard data is completely there that focusing on making a difference to customers, not only is it better in the long term, but it also does deliver short-term results.
And your leaders are really key in terms of how you reach out and touch your employees. I am really surprised at how many companies don't do upward assessments on people that are in leadership and
I'm
are
scared.
Focused just on the they are and are just focused on, you know, bottom line results without focus on is that leader really doing what they need to motivate and bring that team along with them. And I think that's going to have to change if you want to continue to see companies be really successful in the long term.
Well, we also have a new generation of employees. And I have a daughter who's a college student who's one of the most ambitious people I know. But she expects to work very hard. She expects to make a lot of money. And she also expects to like what she does and be emotionally engaged. And I don't think that that is too tall an order.
Yeah, and that has not been the case in years past or in decades past.
I know when I was coming along, the idea was that you would make a lot of money, that the more ambitious of us thought you'd make a lot of money and that that would make you happy, and to which I would ask many people, how's that working out for you? Certainly being poor can make you unhappy, but we all know, you know, all the studies on happiness and job satisfaction say that people need autonomy, yes. mastery, and purpose. Dan Pink, a colleague of mine that just came out with a book to sell as human, but his previous book, Drive, we were talking about the other day, and it's this sense of purpose. It's a human desire. We want to know that we make a difference. And so that's, you know, the studies that you read about 70% of employees are disengaged. Well, no wonder. What are they expected to be engaged in? The CEO telling them how he's going to make his bonus? I mean, that's not really, you know, that doesn't give you long-term employee engagement. And people need to be paid fairly, and financial rewards are very appropriate. But when it's 11 o'clock at night and you've got extra work to do, a bonus is not going to make you stay.
Not going to drive you.
What's going to make you stay is when you know other real live human beings are counting on you.
So this is Global Leader Radio, and we're having a great conversation with Lisa Earle McLeod, the best-selling author of Selling with Noble Purpose, and Becky Blaylock, the author of the upcoming book, upcoming best-selling book, Dare.
Hopefully.
And I'm
put
looking
it out
at
there,
a,
honey.
And I'm looking at a picture of Dare, and it's a beautiful purple color with bold white writing on it. So we talked a little bit about this in the green room. How much input did you have on the way this actually looks? This has just got a bold look to it. I love the way it looks.
Well, it's really interesting, and I'm sure Lisa can talk about this too, because when you go with a published author, a publishing house, and you're a published author, then you have to do a lot of the things that the publisher wants. And so they did ask me up front. They said, you know, you have any advice for us on what you want on the book jacket? And I said, well, the only thing I can tell you, I definitely do not want my picture on the cover of the book. And I said, I don't like the color orange. And I said, anything else you come back with, I'll be fine with. I said, I want something that's sort of clean and simple. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's come back, and there's all kinds of stuff on the front of it. It's not as simple as I want. But they came back with purple. So evidently, purple is going to be the hot color this fall.
And it doesn't have your picture on it either. I think that's a mistake, but that's just me. That's just me. So certainly, Becky, which characteristics, in your opinion, do C-level female executives have that up-and-coming women can emulate as they climb the corporate ladder?
Well, you know, I think if you look at the women that I profiled in this book, they all have incredible integrity. These are women who have lived their lives, you know, with a lot of openness and candor and certainly integrity. These women have all been willing to take some risks. They have self-confidence issues just like anybody else, but they've been willing to challenge themselves to take opportunities when they came along. Even if they weren't 100% qualified for a job, they would jump in and go in and learn it.
Okay.
They are people who are really very focused on the people around them, on their team, really building a quality team of people, and very open to listening to feedback from other people. And and very open to giving back, to bringing that next generation along. They're the kind of people other people want to work for.
Right.
Because, you know, people want to be on your team. If you're someone who coaches and promotes and helps them get to the next level, nobody wants to work for somebody that you go work for them and it's a dead end.
Yeah.
And in fact, one of the pieces and advice from women in the book was, you know, go choose your boss. Pay as much attention to your next boss as you do your next position, because even if it's not the ideal job that you want, if it's working for somebody who's a great leader, who's going to invest in you and help grow you to the next level, then take it.
That's what you want, someone who's focused on that. So with regard to that, Lisa, do these themes differ from up-and-coming women you've met in your practice?
No, they don't. And I mean, I think it's a characteristic of all leaders. I just spoke at a Genentech Women's Leadership Conference. It was a global women's leadership conference. And I looked across at 300 women across the room. And I remember, I'm giving away my age now, 25 years ago, I was part of a women's leadership initiative at Procter & Gamble. And we had the first meeting at my house. Because we didn't want anyone to know. And it was at my kitchen table.
In secret.
Yeah. And one of my, I was about to say girlfriends, but now I'll use a loftier word. One of my colleagues is now the VP of sales at Clorox, and she was at that meeting. And I took a picture with my phone, and I texted her, and I said, this is what we were dreaming about. It actually came true. And so, you know, the notion of taking risk is inherent, I think, in all leaders. And what my research has revealed is we are the boldest and we work the hardest when we are doing it on behalf of a cause greater than ourselves. Mm. And that is the thing, male and female, but I think it particularly applies to women in that we need that extra push sometimes. And so if you believe that you are doing it on behalf of something bigger than yourselves, whether it's on behalf of your customers, whether it's on behalf of your family, whether it's on behalf of you think your voice needs to be added to the leadership conversation. But when you do it on behalf of a cause greater than yourself, you act more boldly, you're more focused, and the confidence gaps that you may have, you're able to overcome them. And a lot of where this is revealed very clearly is with soldiers.
Hmm.
If you ask any soldier who has performed heroically, which there's all different versions of that, they will all admit to you that they're scared.
Mm.
Many times they're scared. But there are two things that enable them to act in the face of fear, and that is being part of a cause greater than themselves, and the other thing is being connected to their team.
Mm.
And so if you think about those, the thing that was revealed is the root of those is love. And, you know, this is a thing that we don't typically talk about in business, and it feels like kind of a mushy thing. But in reality, I came to realize when I started talking about it was we talk about love in business all the time because we want our customers to love us, we want the market to love our stock, and we want our employees to love working there. And so what I have come to see that truly great leaders, be they sales leaders or CEOs or leaders of countries, put love at the front and center of their own actions. And they don't treat love as a noun, as something that they're going to get from other people.
Mm-hmm.
They treat it as a verb, as something that they're going to give. And there's lots of kinds of love. There's romantic love. There's love of country, love of ideals. But at the end of the day, love is about caring passionately about something or someone so that you are willing to go the extra mile. And so the thing that, you know, that Becky has talked about is about this internal talk track and this the emotions that we bring into business. And, you know, people often say, oh, don't get emotional. And that is such bunk. That is mm-hmm. such bunk. Because emotion causes people to act. Okay? Logic causes people to think. Emotion causes people to act. And I think when people say don't get emotional at work, in my experience, what they really mean is please don't yell at me or please don't cry in my office. But what we really want is we want people who are in love with their job,
yes.
who are passionately engaged, emotionally engaged in their work. Because that's how you get emotionally engaged customers. And here's the other little secret. Loving your job is the gateway to loving your life.
That's right. And so we want people that are all in.
All in.
Lisa, you know, I think all that is so important, and that's why the leader is so important, because if you look at the research, the number one reason why people leave their jobs is the relationship with the supervisor. So if you have leaders who can come in and embody, you know, that, you know, we're going to do something that's bigger than who we are and help everybody on their team buy into it, you're going to be a whole lot more capable of hanging on to the employees that you have.
Yeah, yeah, well, that's a good point. Well, I do want to pivot back to something you said earlier, Lisa. You talked about, of course, the love and the emotion and the passion. Can any of that be overdone, in your opinion? Can you have too much of the emotion, too much of the passion?
So the short answer is no. The longer answer is we all know when people are faking it.
Gotcha.
And it's not authentic.
Gotcha.
So you can, through a narrative about how you make a difference to customers, through powerful stories about your business, you can evoke it in yourself and others, but you can't fake it. You know, and that's the point you go that I go back to tag on Becky's point about the boss. I remember when I first became a manager and I was like 25 years old, and my father said to me, "Congratulations, you just became the second most important person in your employees' lives." And I was like, "Oh my God, what are you talking? I'm 25 years old. What are you talking about?" But he said, "You know, next to your spouse, your boss has the power to make your life wonderful or to make your life miserable." And he said, "Think about how many times your mom and I talked about our bosses at the dinner table." And I went, "Oh my gosh, and now that's me." And so I think, can you be fake with too much emotion? Sure. And you don't have to be, you know, I'm an emotionally demonstrative person. I talk about love at work and all that. You don't have to be that person, you know, and that person might not be the best fit everywhere. But there is the essence of quiet leadership that is in service of a cause larger than themselves. And so I think whatever way you bring that love and emotion to bear that matches your own personality style, certainly that's the thing that will get your people engaged.
Okay. So, ladies, when you think through your leadership legacy, what are you most proud of as leaders?
Well, that's easy for me. I've always been about seeing people on my team be successful and go on and do other greater things with their lives or with their careers. I think, you know, when I left, I had always said that I wanted my goal to be able to look back and say, okay, who were the people on my team who got opportunities they would not have gotten otherwise had it not been for opportunities that were created under my leadership?
Lisa?
So I would say probably the thing that I'm the most proud of recently is this book. And I think it's because I was finally able to bring together my very assertive type A sales personality coupled with a very loving, giving spirit that wants the best for all people. And so the work that I've done around this, around letting people know that you can be really assertive and really nurturing and kind in the same space, being able to do that for myself and then being able to now do that for other people, that's probably the thing that I'm the most proud of.
Well, thank you for that. Actually, I know in our conversations about your upcoming book, you use data as well as personal stories, and certainly you're doing it in your book. So you ladies both have a great blend of the interpersonal with the logical in there as well. And and I tell you what, this has made your books very compelling and very easy to read and very easy to enact in as well. So that's pretty important from where I sit. So what do you both do to keep the batteries sharp? How do you recharge and kind of back away from the regular normal workday? And how do you keep yourselves so sharp and in shape?
Silence.
Exercise for one thing. I do try to be very focused on making sure that I get enough exercise. There's just so much research out there now that says that exercise is what can keep you healthy and vibrant. And it's so easy to put that on the wayside. In fact, I always tell people there are lots of things you can delegate in life. You know, you can delegate getting somebody to clean your house. You can delegate getting somebody to hire somebody to drive, carpool your children around. But what you can't delegate is taking care of yourself. So I've tried to be very diligent about making sure that I stay focused on my health and eat right and exercise and do things like gardening, which is another one of my things that kind of helps me chill out and relax.
Oh, I like that.
So, yeah, I'm a slow learner in this category, but probably I would say some of the same things. And one of the things that I have made a vow, I'm approaching a big milestone birthday that I'm not going to share with you. But I'll go ahead and say it. I'm about to be 40-10. And so what I decided was that I was going to manage this next decade of my life a little differently. And one of the vows I made was I was going to start getting 8 hours of sleep.
Wow.
Because all the data shows, and I do exercise, and I've been a lifelong exerciser, and I always try new things. I like to do Bikram yoga, which is that crazy hot yoga that's an hour and a half. But all the data that I've read is around how you make better decisions. You're sharper. You're more focused. And I heard somewhere that Bill Clinton very famously said he made all his worst mistakes when he was tired. And so I think, okay. Well, we all know what some of his mistakes were. I don't think I'm in danger of all of them. But I did take that to heart and say if I really want to optimize, be at peak performance for the next 10 years and like my life, then I need to get 8 hours of sleep a night. So check in with me in 6 months.
And we'll see how things
are
going,
right? And I'll let you know if I'm doing it.
I love that. I love that. So, ladies, I do want to ask you one other question I did not have actually – I didn't think about it until it actually came up in my mind as we were talking. Is there a way for a leader who has run afoul to actually be able to rehab? I mean, can leadership be rehabilitated?
It's very tough if you've done something that's unethical. But certainly people go into situations and they fail at doing something, and maybe they're just in the wrong fit. I've seen people go from being the lowest performer in an organization to being the best performer when you move them to a different area. But I think it's very difficult if you have committed an ethical violation. It's very difficult to recover from that, if ever.
Ethically notwithstanding, then you do see that there is opportunity.
Absolutely. People fail all the time. I mean, I talked earlier about the fact that I've seen people go into jobs and fail. What's the important thing is that you learn from it.
That's right. And so
mistakes are okay. It's just not to make the same ones over and over again. That's what you don't want to do.
Well, you know, I think the other thing, and I do agree, an ethical lapse takes a lot more work to recover from, a lot of personal work. But I think one of the things that I hear from leaders that leaders say is, especially when it comes to some of these emotional things, is, well, I wasn't raised that way. Well, I'm not good at that. And, you know, the thing that I would challenge is, you know, tomorrow's a new day. You know, if you weren't raised to be able to give people praise, get over it.
Yeah.
You know, I heard this one counselor say to someone one time, you're 50 years old. And you keep talking about how you were raised. Are you really going to let two people that have been dead for 10 years dictate the way you behave today? And so a lot of the things, and I mean, I understand that certain things are inherent to our nature. And I've certainly had to struggle to be a better listener because I'm a talker. But just because it's difficult for me doesn't mean that I can't do it or doesn't mean that I don't have a moral obligation to do it. You know, I wasn't born knowing how to do the balance beam. And somehow, you know, by the time I was 12, I learned. So, you know, I think that to say, can a leader recover? I think the secret to recovering any type of failure or poor performance is to be really honest with yourself about what you did.
Got it. Very good. So, ladies, the next to last question on the agenda for today is, which book has most impacted your leadership ability?
You know, I have to tell you that I think growing up, it was not so much a leadership book that impacted me, but I was very impacted by the book Atlas Shrugged. And I guess it's because that book is about a very strong-willed woman who would not compromise on her values and, you know, paid some great prices for sticking to what she really believed in. So from a very early age, I think I was impacted by that particular book. Later in my leadership role, the book The Servant Leader always really stuck with me. One of the examples in that book was that if you want to, you know, be a great boss, sit down and write the job description for your boss. Put everything in there you think your boss ought to be doing. Everything that if that person did that every day would make you really perform and just be a star. Then that becomes your job description. It's very easy to sit on one side of the fence and say, well, I wish my boss would do all these things. But then when you sit there and you write it down and you got to go do it, it's another. It's a reality check. But that book was very instrumental to me in that, you know, you should really be there to serve the people on your team and be a servant to them, because the higher up the ladder you go, the less the job is about you, the more it is about who you surround yourself with. And your job is really to be taking obstacles and roadblocks out of the way so that the people on your team can get the work done.
Fantastic. Lisa?
You know, in thinking about this, I would have to say when I was in college, I read Scott Peck's book, The Road Less Traveled, and that really unlocked the idea for me that we were in charge of our own minds and that our thoughts, ideas, and beliefs affected the way that we were with other people, mm-hmm. and that when we started to change ourselves and started to come to our interactions with others with different beliefs, different thoughts, and different ideas, that everything changed. And so that was just a transformational book for me, and I read it when I was in college.
Fantastic. Becky and Lisa, on behalf of our learning community, I truly appreciate you for accepting the invitation to join us today. I'd love to have you back on the show sometime in the future if we can work out schedules. Mm-hmm. Is that a deal?
Oh, I'd love this. This is great to be with you.
It was great.
Yeah.
Well, good. So with that in mind, could you tell us how our learning community can contact you by email and or by phone?
Well, email for me is blaylock.becky@gmail.com. And I have a website now that is beckyblaylock.com.
Okay.
And those are the two best ways to reach me.
Perfect.
Yeah. So our website is mcleodandmore.com. And there's a button that says contact at the top, and my email goes straight to me, and my phone number's right there on the website. And I will tell you, for listeners, we have a number of things on the website right now. If you click on Sales Leadership Tips, we've got about 10 videos that are really quick, two-minute videos. They're free to watch, so jump on them.
Very nice. And with that response, we'll bring today's edition of Global Leader Radio to a close. We invite all our listeners to check our web presence for previous interviews and links to valuable leadership resources. And also, please drop me an email at acm0996@kennesaw.edu if you have any recommendations for guests. For those of you interested in our award-winning Executive MBA program, please go to the EMBA icon on our Global Leader Radio site to connect to us and sign up for an information session. As a matter of fact, the next information session will be coming up in early June. So join us again at the same location for the next edition of Global Leader Radio, the show that discusses ideas that matter with passionate people who care. So have a great week.
Global Leader Radio is brought to you by the Executive MBA program at Kennesaw State University. Take charge of your personal development and professional career today by learning more at KSUEMBA.com. And join us next week as we discuss ideas that matter with people who care.